A little idle chatter about the people that we know. And though it doesn't matter, is there a different way of saying hello?
You're listening to a podcast of The View, brought to you by the Church of the Larger Fellowship. To subscribe to this podcast, visit www.questformeaning.org or search for Church of the Larger Fellowship in the iTunes Store.
Hi, I'm Meg Riley here today in the Bay Area, California, where it's actually pouring and everybody talks about it like, isn't it terrible? It's raining. And I'm like, to me, I'm happy the drought's over. So I'm still thrilled. The hills are green. It's beautiful here. There's lemon trees and palm trees. Life is good. On a road trip heading for the International Women's Gathering this weekend and then down for Senior Ministers of Large Churches and a CLF board meeting. So I've got a California clump here going on. Joanna, how about you?
Things are good here. Well, for me personally, obviously, in Austin, as other sanctuary cities, a lot of raids going on, so not so great there.
Hi, I'm Aisha in Seattle. We also, speaking of raids, we had a 23-year-old who's been here since he was a child, just picked up in Seattle by ICE. So we are mobilizing around that.
And hi, everyone. This is Terry Bernard running tech tonight. You know, I'm doing well. I'm in St. Paul, Minnesota, and I've got this other job that I just started this week where I'm doing some chaplaincy at a residential reentry center, working with men and women who are finishing out the final months of their prison sentences. And I have to tell you, that work keeps things in perspective. Absolutely. And I'm loving it. Just loving it. So good to be with those people and good to be with you all here today.
Thanks, Terry. We're joined by Kenny Wiley from Black Lives of UU and Lena Gardner, who has another thing, will be joining us. Kenny, how's it going?
Well, thanks for having me again, Meg. It's always good to be on The View. And I'm currently in my apartment in Denver, Colorado. We had a UU church, a First Unitarian, that is housing an activist, Jeanette Vizguerra, and which is a great thing. But the fact that it has to happen, of course, is not great. So there's a lot of energy, a lot of sadness, and a lot of perseverance in the activist community and in the UU community, which are beautifully intertwined here in Denver. So that's what's up.
Yeah, these raids are happening everywhere. And that, you know, Obama was called deporter in chief. 2.5 million people were deported under Obama, but these feel different. A minister posted about somebody related to her congregation, a young adult who's lived here since he was two, got picked up for a speeding ticket in Kansas, and whoa, he's back in Central America. It feels like we are definitely in a new phase where if speeding is your criminal conviction, we're not talking about getting rid of criminals. We're talking about mass deportations. And of course, many of us are looking at the Dreamers and wondering, since they basically stepped forward and gave their information, what I think there's one now. I've seen one Dreamer has been deported, but allegedly they're claiming that he was a gang member and that's why. But yeah, it's a scary time. I think a lot of us are hearing boots on the ground with these roundups.
So here in Austin, we were already hearing the drumbeats of this because our governor has decided to make this an issue. They're trying to pass something through the Texas legislature, getting rid of sanctuary cities. And he's actually, I believe what he said is, we're going to bring the hammer down, which is really a bizarre thing when the governor of your state is talking about cities in your state. But yeah, we're, you know, every day people are posting information about raids in certain neighborhoods. One thing that was very disheartening was the Austin ISD sent out a notice to all teachers telling them that they could not tell their students of their rights. They had been doing that. They had been, you know, passing around the thing from the ACLU about, you know, no, they have to have a warrant, etc. And AISD, very disappointingly, said, no, that's political.
constitutional rights are political now.
Yeah.
So are they honoring that? I mean, do they have?
I don't. If they are not honoring it, which knowing so many of the teachers, I would expect that they are not. But they're of course, not getting on Twitter and saying it.
Aisha, it's been happening in your area too. I know.
Yeah, but I have. I'm in Washington State, and our governor, who I kind of thought was milquetoast, came out at when the first ban happened, went to the airport and just blasted the Orange Menace and just said, we are not having it. And our city in Seattle, Ed Murray, the mayor, we are going to remain a sanctuary city regardless of what the federal government says. So our governor is doing the exact opposite of what's happening in Texas. And he's very clear. And actually, I actually was one of the judges here and our attorney general. I mean, the state, at least those in power right now who happen to be Democrats are very much mobilizing against what's happening. So,
right. I mean, of course, to be clear, Lena keeps coming and going. Lena Gardner is clearly trying to join us and will be here from Black Lives Matter. All that being a sanctuary city means is that your police won't collaborate with ICE. It doesn't mean that ICE can't do raids. Right.
And that's the thing. I mean, exactly. And ICE is doing raids. And so it's going to be an interesting tension because there has been ever since legal pot between what the feds do and what local police do. And actually where the churches in Bellevue, which is the city right next to Seattle, basically are working very closely with the community and are bending over backwards, trying to build bridges and let folks know that they will not put them in harm's way. So, there's hope in that. I actually had a moment of panic because I was not born in this country. As I said, I was born in Egypt. And it's just a piece of paper. You know, my white husband thinks I'm overreacting, who was born in New York City. And I said, well, it's easy for you to say. I only have a piece of paper. I don't have anything that says I was born here. So who knows that that's not going to be one day I don't know. I mean, at this point, I don't know that there's a limit to the cruelty, frankly. It's not even crazy. It's cruel. Where's our humanity? I saw Trayvon Martin's parents yesterday. And one of the things that his mother, Sabrina Fulton, ended with was, my son was not murdered because he was wearing a hoodie. He was murdered because of the color of his skin. And she said, we have a moral imperative to fix this. I mean, it was really, the whole night was amazing. But I just keep thinking about that. We have a moral imperative. And our churches, I have less and less patience for white people who just want to stay comfortable. And I'm really having to check myself because it's making me angry. Sorry.
No, that's nothing to apologize for. Hi, Lena. Yeah, I saw them on TV and I cried. So I can't imagine seeing them in person. They were amazing people.
Yeah, I got to meet them because they did a book signing. Really, really warm and kind, strong people.
I went yesterday here in San Francisco to the Chinese Cultural Center has a display on Chinese immigration history. And boy, is it deja vu all over again, looking at, you're in, oh no, the Chinese Exclusion Act, you're out, oh, Mexico, you're out. I mean, just all of the cruelty and the suffering and that was a really good exhibit. And it was like, God, can we not learn anything from history? Can we just not learn anything? I mean, so many of the language, everything, it's just exactly the same. So, yeah. In fact, I didn't know green cards were invented for Chinese people. That's how the first paper ID was about Chinese people. Anyway, I just feel like over and over, and it's the Irish people, my people, who really turned on the Chinese workers and in many cases massacred them, fighting for pennies while these billionaire tycoons built the railroad. And are we ever gonna get it? This is divide and conquer. I just feel like for white people, if we don't get that what can be done to somebody can be done to everybody in a culture and see that, among other things, it is our own self-interest to not allow these cruel and dehumanizing policies, we're just stupid. I'm sorry. That sounds elitist, but we are. We're just stupid. Well, I'm excited that Kenny and Lena looks like you came in and out, a little visitation going on, Lena Gardner.
Oh, good. Yes, I had a presentation at my high school. So I'm actually in a computer lab at my high school, and I think they had some what you can access. And so I actually just had to switch over to my phone. So happy to
scurry over. What were you talking to your high school about?
About Black Lives Matter Minneapolis and the movement.
Well, I mean, let's talk about the convening. It's coming up soon. It's around the corner. I'm sure you're feeling that. Convening. How's it going?
So I can just say I'm really excited. I think we have around 90 registrants, and we're in, you know, getting all the travel arrangements and all of the things that go with planning for folks' arrival. I'm really excited about, you know, the worship services. It's, you know, we have the presidential forum that we're going to hopefully live stream with CLF. Then, you know, we have some of the folks from the groups in 1968, some of the folks that left that are going to come and talk with us and share their wisdom and insight. And so it feels, you know, it's kind of a historic thing, and I'm pretty excited to be I will let Kenny talk about the youth programming and the things he's doing and I was excited about.
Yeah, well, not just me, Lena. We've got another member of the call. Aisha will be also...
I'm so excited.
No need to apologize for that. We've got over a dozen high school youth registered for, you know, what's exciting is I imagine many of you are familiar with this idea of mixing and huddling with, you know, age or race or gender cohorts. And so we're going to spend some time with the adults and the high schoolers. And then there's also going to be some times where they're doing their own thing and having conversations about what it is to be a Black UU and to be a teenager, and, you know, some activities, probably some going around town in New Orleans. Especially excited about is both for our youth, but also for Black folks of any age, you know, the convening, some of it's going to be about politics and, you know, how do we want to use our power in this faith? And some of it's just going to be about feeling connected. That when you know that, you know, there's someone in Memphis or someone in Portland who goes through similar things that you do, it helps you feel less alone. And that's true whether you're 15 or whether you're 50. So just really excited for folks to feel a part of something larger. And that's, you know, Aisha and Kimberly Quinn Johnson and I are going to be primarily focused on high schoolers, but that's true for everyone who I think is going to attend. And so we're really, really pumped.
It's great. It's so exciting. And what good timing, really. I mean, Aisha, what you said about just the anger and every person of color I know was just like, I'm sorry, I love you, but I can hardly look at white people right now, you know? And
yeah. I've gotten to the point where I feel like if there's a UU church, and I know there are, that are genuinely having the argument about how social justice and spirituality combine, as if that's even a thing, right? As if it's not like like the air we breathe, right? How are your lungs going to work without air? How is spirituality a thing without justice? I think stop being a UU church. Just be a society. Just be ethical culture. Do whatever the hell you want, but don't people. I have an expectation of a faith community to stand up for what's right, and it's more than centering whiteness, making sure that the feelings of white people are taken into account more than the pain and frankly murder of Black and brown bodies and termination, extermination. So I genuinely have no more patience for that, because we are living right now. This is it. This is Nazi Germany and the civil rights movement and Trail of Tears all flipping rolled into one.
Yeah. And Aisha, I want to add to that there's, I feel like, a battle within some congregations about whether we're going to be a random society, you know, that does nothing, or whether we're going to be a church that really speaks to these times. Because I find it offensive when you use talk about, like, we literally talk about every person having inherent worth and dignity. And if we don't actually act as though that we believe that, then we should just say something else, you know, and just stop wasting people's time.
Amen.
But I just think that there's a lot in a lot of congregations. I'm hearing that there's a real battle for the soul of of churches and what they're going to do in these times.
So you're hearing that from a lot of congregations?
Yeah. And I think especially ones that, you know, First Unitarian Denver, geographically, it's really well positioned. It's right, you know, in the heart of the city. But I think especially a lot of congregations that can tell themselves that, like, oh, well, that's happening in the, you know, a different part of the city. That's happening in a different part of the state. Oh, we're in this, like, Republican enclave. Oh, we're in the most liberal place in the state. Like, there's a lot of ways you can tell yourself that, oh, we're not up yet, you know. We'll be ready whenever the time comes. But like, there's so many ways to help, even if it's a little less directly.
Well, the sanctuary congregations are certainly one interesting movement. And I don't know how many of you, the World actually just did a story on it, but I haven't read it. But I did see the headline. But I don't know how many of your congregations have stepped forward. I know in the Twin Cities, a number of them are looking at this. You know, that's one family. So we need mass. We need something much bigger than that. But it is a really significant thing for congregations to do that. And it certainly changes the sense of who they are to do that personal connection for people. Well, we had Katya Hansen on saying, you know, you can have people live with you, but you can also do a whole lot of other things, like train people to be ready to go out when these roundups are happening and other things like that. I do know from my colleagues in other faiths that they envy Unitarian Universalists. I'm talking white mainline churches primarily, who are just pilloried and mute for the most part. Some of the UCC churches are up and at them, but a lot of them are, boy, I wouldn't want to be serving one of them at all. It's going to be a time.
The difference is, Meg, I mean, I hear you, but the mainline Christian churches are mainline Christian churches. So however stuck they choose to be or whatever, however they want to interpret, because the Bible is used to justify slavery. So that's one thing. But Unitarian Universalists, we are supposed to be the faith of liberation theology. So we need to maybe start reteaching people what that means. So it's more what my disappointment and frankly anger is that we are saying we are something different. Frankly, I think Nancy McDonald Ladd said it best, these fake fights in our church, because we can then avoid our humanity. As Kenny said, we find every single reason we're not in a liberal place. Oh, we are in a liberal place. And at some point we have to start finding our humanity. We have to stand up for humanity. Otherwise, like I said, be something else, be a club, be a society of ethical culture, and you can intellectually decide what the hell that is. But anyway.
And I'll just say, Amanda Poppy from the Ethical Culture Society in DC, who's super active around this stuff, would be going, no, we're not just a society. We're out there. I'm getting arrested. I'm doing stuff. So I'll just include her because she's very active.
That's a good point. Thank you.
I agree with you. I mean, the day after Trump got elected, I wrote to CLF and was like, look, if you voted for this guy and say you're Unitarian Universalist, talk to me because he is antithetical to everything we are. And of course, it's not just Trump, it's Congress. Congress is the real problem here. This is the agenda they've had for a really long time. And we had a question from Ann Burns, one of our loyal watchers, asking us for something that we're going to talk about anyway, but I'll bring it up now. All the laws coming up, both in states and the executive order basically criminalizing protests, which are definitely aimed at Black and brown protesters. There's no question in the world the intention of these. I mean, in Minnesota, there was one that protesters should have to pay for necessary police. And I know from going to different events that where police are seen as necessary is completely about racism, nothing else. And then to imagine, you know, my kid coming home beat up and then asked to pay for the privilege of having been beat up by the police. It is, and this is happening. This is an ALEC bill that's happening in all kinds of states. And we have a governor who will veto it. But what can you, how's organizing these days? What does organizing look like in Black Lives of UU and in communities that you're connected to?
Well, I can speak a little bit to that and say, actually, it's not certain that Dayton will veto that bill in our state. It, at least I've been hearing movement folks talk about this for a while, that the backlash is coming. People who study history know this is kind of the cycle of uprising and repression and uprising and repression. And so all I can say is that I think there's a serious discussion afoot right now about different tactics and shifting them and what that will look like. There is a commitment to shifting tactics in recognition that the world around us is shifting, and to also continue to say, so what does it look like to also keep pushing that envelope, knowing that it's going to be putting people at higher risk? You know, it's been coming. It's been sort of a slow, rise up. But yeah, we still, trying to defeat it. I think also something that I know we've been talking about on Blue and in other organizing spaces is how do we move from reactionary to visionary and building and responsive? And that's really, I think, what the convening is about, is that really shifting into what are we building and how to build that out and organize from that, a space of, visionary, beloved community, I think is where a lot of the conversations that I am taking a part of and talk around strategy is happening. So that's part of why I'm so excited for the convening, because I think it is this coming together and saying, where are we and where do we want to go from here?
You know, I just got a couple emails and there's so much organizing happening. And what I keep thinking about is when predominantly white groups interact with police, that I think there's actually a lot of power, to the extent that you can, sort of like pushing away the benefits of how police treat predominantly white groups in general. There's a few exceptions, but and a couple examples I can think of that include, just the narrative, when white folks attend something and the police are super respectful. Like just ignoring or saying nothing is totally an option, right? You don't have to be actively antagonistic toward police at an action, but in your rhetoric afterward, especially just like not for not being awful. I mean, like, cool, that's literally what they're supposed to do, right? So in Denver, which is a predominantly white city, what's really valuable is when we don't give police credit they don't necessarily deserve. I'm thinking of, there's an airport, all those airport actions a couple weeks ago. And, we had 500 or 600 folks in the main terminal of Denver International Airport. And what was really fascinating was the organizers, many of whom were Arab American, were really complimentary of police. And, as a Black person at that action, it wasn't my action. It wasn't like for me to say anything in the moment, but there was definitely a feeling of, why are we praising them for allowing us to exist? And I just think that being clear about what our rights actually are, whatever these laws are going to be saying for a while, like we know what act, this idea that we have to apply, for, that like, oh, well, you didn't put in your First Amendment rights in time, so you can't be here. You didn't submit them 36 hours in advance. I mean, just like resisting that. And sometimes that can lead to arrest, but a lot of times in big enough groups, it won't. And so just the clarity from everyone on, what is actually right here, that you can be committed to nonviolence, but let's not conflate what nonviolence is. Standing and singing songs, after you've been told to leave, outside an airport terminal, like, that's not violence. And let's not fall into that false narrative that it is. So just a couple of thoughts, from Denver on that. But overall, just a lot of the rhetoric around people who are new and predominantly white groups who are so complimentary of police, I think it really hurts Black and brown people. It really does. So.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, it really does create the narrative that, like, see if you just behave right, which is what so many white people think about the police, despite massive, massive visual and every other kind of evidence to the contrary. One of the other parts of Ann Burns' question is, how are you showing up in this, in these orders, executive and otherwise, that are criminalizing protests? And what I would say, and I'm curious about your responses, is that I've been dismayed by how little attention those have been getting compared to some other things. So is there stuff I'm not seeing? Should I be less dismayed?
I have noticed the same thing. But I think there is sort of a, at least in Denver, and there's some UUs showing up to these meetings, there's a bit of confusion on what is the best way to mobilize, because some of them just sort of organically, you know, like that Saturday when the executive order came out, you know, about the Muslim ban, it just sort of organically, everyone's like, let's go to the airport, right? And so how do you get folks mobilized when there isn't the anti-Blackness, when there isn't that sort of organic push to do something? So I'm curious to see what Lena has to say.
I've definitely seen or experienced that and echo those experiences. I've also seen, I saw a lot of, in particular, white women UUs mobilized by the Women's March. And I do see a lot of those folks sort of grappling with this inundation kind of into a whole new, you know, movement, sort of social justice movement that they haven't necessarily been exposed to before, and really struggling with, you know, challenges around being inclusive from people like myself and other POC and Indigenous women, and lots of other challenges. But yeah, I think there has been, you know, silence too, and I'll even say from the UA leadership, right? Like, I think about the statement that we put out on the heels of the Muslim ban when it came out. Like, we were really called as blue to, like, to do that right away because it was so clear to us how wrong it was. And I just feel like, you know, I don't have really good words for it. There is this sort of, are stunned a little bit at all the things that are happening so fast. But I do also see who were pretty mobilized by the Black Lives Matter movement here in Minneapolis, at like First Universalist, for instance, coming forth and planning all these new things and being really mobilized. But yeah, in direct response to the executive orders, I think it's been kind of quiet overall.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, we're all trying to prioritize of the many assaults where we can best have impact and be effective. And as I look at it, when I look around most cities, you know, like I was stunned to learn that the UUs in Bismarck, Mandan were the only white congregation support, and predominantly white, not all white, but supporting the water carriers. And as I look around cities, we are mostly the only churches with Black Lives Matter signs hanging up. And so, yeah, what are we going to do? What I've said to myself is, all of this environmental stuff is horrible, and I'm going to trust that there's a huge community that's going to fight about that. And I'm going to just be horrified, but I might make my 5-minute phone calls about it, but in terms of where my creative energy goes, that's not the best fit. And so how are we as a denomination focusing on what we have said is a core value of anti-racism and anti-oppression for all these years? So maybe what we have to do is include in our 5-minute phone calls, calls to Peter Morales. You heard it here first, but there might be some in the UUA lobbying also. And believe me, he hears from me regularly. I encourage people to talk to him. He's going to respond to demand.
Yeah, so I will toss this out, and I know that I believe Kenny has some thoughts on this. What about this whole, Meg, you're just talking about focusing, and I think this is an issue that at least on social media keeps coming up, and that is the, no, you can't think about this, you need to, that's a distraction, you need to focus on this. So Kenny, what do I focus on?
Yeah, Joanna, I think Meg's framing was really great, right? Is that there's the simultaneous need to trust, right? That I'm going to trust Allie Tharp or Elizabeth Mount or some of the UU environmental activists I know, and I'm going to do some smaller actions when called on, right? And, you know, okay, so they're saying, those folks are saying, call these folks. So I can take 90 seconds and do that, but I'm not going to organize, you know, I'm not going to organize the phone tree or anything because I'm focused on some other things. But to me, where it gets problematic is the sort of policing, you know, that if we, if you're not focused on the environment, then you're doing it wrong. If you're not, you know, how dare you post about, you know, Beyonce losing however many times to Adele, because you know, Trump's doing this and he's distracting, and, you know, it's like, it all matters. I mean, to some degree, right? And And I think it's sort of not giving us enough credit. I can be sitting right over there in my beloved chair and watching the Grammys and also typing emails, you know, to get people mobilized for an event that's happening tonight. And the truth is that there are lots of ways, and that it's going to take many of those together in order to make a lasting resistance. So anytime I see someone say, we've got to be mobilizing toward 2018, like, well, yeah, that's true. And some things are happening in the meantime. Like, why can't we do both?
I think one of the things I think about too in this discussion of bandwidth is around making sure folks know that the work is not just external. There's a temptation, I think, because people are so moved by anger and sadness and other feelings, to just kind of dive into this frenzied, I need to call this person, this person, this person, and I need to go to this march and this march and this march. But one of the things I've been doing, and I talked about it last night at Representative Ilhan Omar's event, is also reminding folks that this work is both internal and external, that there's a lot of work we all need to be doing, especially when you're new to movement, to be thinking about the areas that you have privilege and how those impact and influence your work. Now, you can't do that outside of community, and you can't do that outside of accountable, authentic relationships, and you can only build those in community and doing direct actions and building relationships with organizers. So, you know, I think this question of who do I listen to and which thing do I do, you know, in a way, you could almost pick anyone. I think it's beautiful the amount of groups I'm seeing that are like, let's talk about white privilege, let's talk about you know, what we want to be doing and the ways we want to resist. I think it's actually really, really, really beautiful, even as it is also a little blisteringly like, wow, this is a lot happening. This is a lot going on. And so I just feel like that's really important.
Let's go back to Beyoncé for a minute, though, because isn't part of resistance creativity and art and beauty and joy? And I mean, that's something I've learned, especially from oppressed communities. Like, we're not just going to wait and be happy when we have freedom. We're going to be, it's part of survival, yeah. And thriving is part of resistance, especially for people who are marginalized.
Yeah. So I had friends over last night, and all UUs, and there's one other person of color in the group of eight. What was fascinating, I suppose, is just how like people of color kind of have to be fluent in white culture, especially in our faith. And so we were playing songs from the 90s and the early 2000s. What was amazing was like, we knew all these songs by white bands, and then Erykah Badu came on and it was just like silence, except for my friend Jordan and me. And that was just really, that was really helpful for me, because it sort of brought into sharp relief a few things. And, you know, on the night that Beyonce's album dropped, like, that's a night I won't forget, because so many Black folks, joined by other people of color and some white folks, were just like, this is the most amazing thing I've ever seen. And it was just like, and just realizing how few of my white friends, including my white UU friends, were aware that that was happening at all, right? It's one thing to just say, well, you know, Beyonce is okay. I think that's a perfectly reasonable thing for someone to say, but to not even be aware that this sort of cultural moment was even happening, you know? So last night we were singing Call Tyrone, which is like a legendary Erykah Badu song. And it was just like, the white folks had no clue what was going on. But yeah, you have to have joy, like, brought so much joy and so much reality to the surface. And I think a lot of folks just completely missed it, including too many of the Grammy voters, apparently.
Well, I mean, I'm always aware that what she's doing, I'm missing 9/10 of it culturally, but I thought that piece of hers was just mythic. I mean, it just hit on this absolutely mythic spiritual level that I was like, how could anyone not see that? I mean, I was like weeping. It was It was
she's church. A queen reincarnated. There's it no doubt behind. It was church, queen, so. Like literal queen reincarnated. There's no other explanation for it.
Oh, I was also just going to lift up that, you know, this is something that Reverend Sekou talks about, which is also, I think, an idea, you know, Nina Simone talks about, is that in the time of monsters is when the artist, it's their time, right? That all of us living out kind of need that energy, need that sustenance, and need that, you know, sometimes spiritual grounding to be able to fighting, but also even just to keep going, because it is, it's a really terrifying time for many, many people. So I think that, that insight is absolutely right on. And that's something I feel like maybe being in Minneapolis, where there is such a strong arts community, that is something that people have consistently lifted up. But I think it's going to be more important now, more than ever before, especially since we're also going to see a crackdown on, you know, protests and other strategies that we've used. It's going to be important to have different creative things. I'm, you know, thinking about and looking at the Augusto Boal's, you know, Theater of the Oppressed tactics. I know other people are looking at things called, you know, calling them ethical spectacles, and really starting to push the artistic front even further in these times.
So let's go back to all these new people, primarily white people, showing up and being like, we're starting a movement. How do you think UU congregations might be useful in this moment with especially these new folks showing up?
I mean, I think there are very concrete things like offering space to organizers. This is something Blue has helped facilitate in the past and continues to champion and say, you know, offering up church space for organizers, but then also recognizing that that doesn't mean that you get, you know, access to their meetings or to their needs or to them if you're truly offering up space just to be space for them. I think really finding some ways to do work that is internal but not so insular. I think about my church, I go to First Universalist. I think there has been some really good work there around whiteness and thinking about what it is, and then also supporting the people of color and indigenous folks within the congregation as well to work through their identities and the ways that internalized oppression has affected them. So providing resources, really investing, you know, money too in those. So like, I know people have brought in trainers and done that work and then continued to show up in community spaces and in organizing. So it's a both and. It's showing up and then doing your work and building relationships. I also feel like I struggle a little bit with this because I was saying, you know, people are just now getting to the point where they're like, oh, we think protest is, yeah, we want to protest. And I'm like looking at it like you're late to the party and this is no longer an effective tactic, right? Like protest makes a whole lot of sense under a petitionable government. But we no longer have a petitionable government. And so how do you, I think that's the question a lot of organizers are sitting with, is how do you bring people along a trajectory at like a pretty fast speed that like I wasn't brought, I mean, I was brought along faster than other people coming, being like just thrown into the hot water with the Black Lives Matter movement. But, you know, that is a question I think we're all sitting with. So for me, concrete things just comes back to resources and, you know, basically you can give money to groups, you know, and I would, you know, privilege POC, Black-led and Indigenous-led groups underfunded and under-resourced. So you can start with investment of your money, offering of space, and then commitment to doing your own internal work, but not doing so in a way that is completely disconnected from the people most directly affected by some of this stuff. So those are some of the things I think about, but it is a tough question. I invite all of, you know, the congregations, you know, to, you can make a donation to Blue, right? To fund this convening that we have coming up. There's a lot of resources that you can do. And I've been thinking myself about how Blue can be sort of a directory or help folks to funnel, you know, resources and offerings into the hands of local organizers.
Yeah, I appreciate your framing of internal work and not being insular. And maybe that's the opportunity for Unitarian Universalist communities, that what does it mean to do internal work, not in an insular way, right? So one question for me would be, So this is interesting. It's when, you know, the current regime is voted in that suddenly you're feeling afraid, white person, and uncomfortable. Why, you know, that's, you feel that, hear that, and listen to that, and then ask yourself, why weren't you uncomfortable when 12-year-old Tamir Rice was murdered or 17-year-old Trayvon Martin? And then grapple with that, right? And grapple with it in relationship to other white people who have done the work, who are maybe further along and not, you know, I would say don't start with grilling a POC, a person of color or a black person. Please don't do that. But definitely, maybe that's the opportunity of our churches, that that could be the place to ask ourselves, what is our moral obligation? I love when Reverend Barber talks about the moral, use moral language. This isn't even about being political. It's about morality. And so what does it mean to be, do internal work, think about what our morality is in relationship to others and not in an insular way, not making it about just making ourselves feel better that bad things are happening.
I think that sometimes regulation in predominantly white spaces can be really huge. So every time, you know, anytime you hear, yes, what a movement that we're starting, you know, there's some powerful in just simply correcting whoever said that. I think that a lot of times can help reframe around where we see ourselves in it. That if you see yourself as starting something, you may see yourself as a leader versus as a participant.
What I see in the tone policing with white people right now, of other white people, I'm going to leave aside the tone policing of people of color, you shouldn't be happy. Nothing should make you happy right now. And it's not funny. I personally, the humorous are saving my life a lot of days because I have so many emotions, and to release some of them through laughter, like Samantha Bee, I wouldn't miss it, you know? So it's interesting to me what people know who have lived a lifetime this way and what people know who have had 4 weeks of hell, you know? Like, not that it hasn't been 4 weeks of hell for everybody, but for some people it's on top of a lifetime. And I've asked my 20-year-old kid like 15 times, who says, I already knew it was this bad. Like, it's, this isn't, right. My body didn't go into shock the way that yours did. And it's just physically a different experience. And I think because Unitarian Universalists are so grounded in personal experience as the foundation of truth and life, without, say, the Bible or, you know, somebody else, it can really reinforce oppressive and privileged tendencies, because whatever I experience is the center of life. And so I think it is a wonderful faith development opportunity that we're having, among other things, you know. And I, well, yeah.
And a way to break out of, on the serious side, dualistic thinking and opening people up to both. And I happened to turn on Chris Hayes last night, and Susan Sarandon was on there. And I think that there is, you know, and she was trying to shut down the conversation in terms, and it was almost as if everything was being framed as, there is nothing new that is happening here. It has always been this way. And I think that there is some value in saying, there are things that we have ignored that, yes, have always been this way. And there's some stuff that we're dealing with now that we weren't dealing with in October, you know? And so I think there's a real spiritual component for you use of saying, you know what, I can hold two realities at the same time.
Or multiple realities. Somebody asked, actually Terry behind the chalice, if anything's happened with the statement of conscience that the UUA and UUSC put out. I don't know. I signed it weeks ago. Has anybody seen it anywhere? Is it doing anything? Is it alive in congregations?
Yeah. You know what I'd like?
That I know of.
If I could say my fantasy, I'd like to ordain every white person in a UU congregation and have them go march, just like the women's conference march. Have it be white people go out the next time a black brown person is shot and murdered by police, and with stoles on, and everyone's a minister and clergy, and have them face the riot police. That's what we should do. Like, you know, okay, white people, go out and face the tanks and face the people, you know, do that, and have it all be white people, and say, no, we're going to stand, and we're going to, you know, not be okay with this. And everybody's ordained. Let's ordain everybody. And we all are ministers and going to fight for justice.
The priesthood of all believers. There you go.
Yeah, I mean, the statement of conscience, I know that there was a lot of energy around it when it came out. And I know my congregation was pretty excited. And I do wonder, you know, and I'm a UUA employee, so, you know, I should tread carefully here, but I do wonder if things like that help spur action or if they are if they become a replacement for action. I think even as a UUA employee, it's a fair question to ask because I'm not sure. And maybe in some cases it's both. I want to see more things that help truly mobilize, you know, like Aisha's pointing us toward. I don't know what that looks like, but I think it's a lot of times it's about connection to help folks really understand the landscape of a city that, you know, every city has its own organizing structure and history and platforms. And, you know, in one city, definitely call the NAACP. In another city, definitely don't call the NAACP. Like it's just, and that can be tricky for folks to figure out. But I think I just want to encourage people to do the research, to have the conversations instead of just making assumptions about what it means to get involved and to go beyond just signing things. Even though signing things is cool.
Yeah, absolutely, Kenya and Aisha. I think also one of the things I think about too is really re-envisioning what resistance means and looks like, because there is this idea that it has to be all of these grandiose measures or marching in the streets, and that's true, and it could be just meeting your neighbors. This is something that I know I've been really learning from Linda Sarsour, Women's March, is that how many people know all of their neighbors on their whole block? And how many people could, if they needed to in a pinch, run to them and say, I really need your help. And so part of it, I think, too, is really is just basic community building or base building, you know, to put it in organizer terms, right, is to really reach out. I know when I was presented with that challenge, I was like, oh, I know a couple people, but I don't know everyone on my block. What would it mean to start thinking about that sort of hyper-local focus? And thinking of community building and building relationships as resistance, because in the end it is. And in the end, people show up for, you know, the people they have relationships with. I've watched over the past 2 years, and they're willing to take more risks the deeper in relationship they are to somebody. The past 2 years, some white youths and some, you know, other white folks of faith in particular who have developed a relationship with me or with Black Lives Matter in Minneapolis and have now, you know, now they are willing to get arrested or now they are willing to be out in the streets and face the tanks with us. But that's not because they suddenly had some like epiphany that their liberation is connected to mine. We've built a relationship together. I think that makes a difference. And that doesn't happen, as I call it, in the crucible of crisis, right? Those building of relationships don't happen there. They happen in the everyday moment and in moments where you can just really share, you know, more parts of who you are with each other in genuine ways. And so that's also something I've been really encouraging to people, is if you feel overwhelmed, you know, by like organizers or the social justice movement or stuff like that, you know, just start on your own block, start with people you don't know, and move out from there. You know, I think especially in Minnesota, where we're pretty segregated in our communities, that could go a long ways towards helping this movement to be more durable for the long term.
My closing thought to build on Lena's amazing thoughts there is that I work a lot with youth in Colorado in the Western region of the Rocky Mountain part. And what's fascinating is one of the decisions that the youth have made as an act of resistance is to get better at talking to each other, is to get better at small talk, to get better at medium level talk, as they say. What I found really moving about that was the recognition on their part, in order to resist what's going on out there, we have to, as Lena said, work on what's within. And that if we're not good at talking to each other, we can't really get to know each other. And so that's an example that some high schoolers out here are setting that I think could be, you know, a good illustration for us all, that relationship building and internal work within ourselves is really as much a part of this as, you know, calling Cory Gardner or whatever senator is being terrible today.
The youth are so great at teaching us about community over and over. I've learned so much from them. Thank you so much to both of you for coming. I'm really excited. Next month, we'll get to hear about the convening. That'll be really fun. And all you'll right. both be, Lena especially, a little more relaxed about it, I'm sure. It's been wonderful spending the hour with you. And talk to a neighbor, do some thinking, do some reading, get out in the streets, call somebody, just live your life in a bold, beautiful way. Take care.
This has been a podcast of The View, brought to you by the Church of the Larger Fellowship. To find out more about the CLF, visit questformeaning.org.